In 1899, at The Hague, leaders from governments around the world met to hold what was called the First Hague Peace Conference. And despite the effort, the conference made very little progress, but at the grassroots level in Western countries, there was the hope that something would ultimately be accomplished, so they pressed for more of these meetings. The governments met again in 1907, but with similar results. The U.S. Secretary of State at the time pressed for a third conference, believing that they must capitalize on even the little progress that was made, but that third conference was canceled. Ironically, World War I interrupted it. And they didn't get around to holding the third conference until 1999. This last one had a very different flavor than the first two. Essentially, it was a non-governmental meeting that looked back at the first two conferences and talked once again about a future for world peace. And nothing has come of it, because most of us didn't even realize there was such an event, right? Interestingly, the first two conferences preceded the bloodiest century in history. Over 93 million people lost their lives in the 20th century due to war. So much for the progress of modern civilizations. And the 1999 conference was held on the eve of the 21st century in the hope that the world had finally learned its lesson and was ready to turn the page. But just barely into it, we once again found ourselves mobilizing troops, bombing our enemies, and being ever creative in our skills of war. All in an effort to have peace. Tomorrow is the 22nd anniversary of 9/11, the eve of the longest war in U.S. history. Sad irony, isn't it? We go to war so that we can have peace. At least that's what we tell ourselves. So far, it hasn't worked. Now, perhaps there is a temporary cessation of hostilities, but that cessation is always very tenuous indeed. Sometimes just a spark is all it takes to cause us to believe that another war is a very appropriate response. Years ago, I was visiting friend and his church in Belfast, Northern Ireland. My friend lived and ministered on the Shankill Road. You ever heard of the Shankill Road? Maybe you have if you've read history. During the Troubles, all of the bombings with the Irish Republican Army, etc., Shankill Road was right the center of that. Violent demonstrations, fightings, guerrilla attacks. My friend was driving me around the city, showing me the different neighborhoods, the Catholic and Protestant neighborhoods, if you know the history. And I remember asking him what the city was like now that violence or overt violence isn't the norm. And I said, are people really getting along? Are they using the same grocery stores and restaurants and pubs and community centers now? Or are they still segregated, and what's happening? I said, surely they're getting along. And he said, oh no, no, no. He said, it's always bubbling right under the surface. He said, all it takes is a little spark and everything would explode again. This is while I was staying over with him a couple of nights there on the Shankill Road. Like, great. Peace in Belfast? We're pretending if we think it's real. I mean, look at our own city, right? When I moved here in 2012, Portland was a cool, hipster, live and let live kind of place. At least that's the vibe of it. But then the pandemic and national events during the pandemic unearthed a profoundly different spirit that continues to simmer. And at least to me, I could be wrong, but at least to me, it feels like it's ready to boil over at any moment. Peace in Portland? Maybe more like a temporary cessation of hostilities, but nothing of the sort of peace that a Christian might desire. What does God call the church to be and do in such a world? In such a world of conflict? Maybe the text from an old, surly Old Testament prophet is a surprising one for a sermon about peace. But Isaiah is casting a vision for what the restoration of exiled Israel while they were in Babylon would be like, would look like, when they returned to Jerusalem. And the promises are glorious, aren't they? Did you feel your heart getting warmed as Twyla read those for us? These events would be marked by prosperity to the extreme. Peace with God, peace with each other, and with the nations around them. The restoration will be so great that even the sun and moon will become redundant because the glory of God will be there. Everyone who lives there will be righteous. No one need worry about being displaced from home in the wake of our modern experience with war. It's a peace-filled existence that just sounds too good to be true. And, funnily enough, it did not come true when the exiles returned. Because, as it turns out, they brought back with them the same problems that they took into Babylon in the first place. But take heart. This doesn't mean that hope is lost and violence should win the day. The New Testament rigorously maintains that there will be a time when all of these glorious promises of Isaiah 60 will be a reality. When? How? Who? Where is the modern church in Isaiah 60? Is this ultimate restoration something we simply huddle together and wait for? Is this peace just a fantasy? Or couldn't we begin to see it even now? For all the failures of national Israel, it's striking to me that the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, makes the idea of nation a prominent and key feature. When the nation spirals as badly as it did after King Solomon's reign, it splits apart, both north and south are carried into exile. And after all of that, you would think that when we arrive in the New Testament, the nation language would completely disappear, and it would be replaced with talk of privatized religion, individual commitments, personal relationship with there, to some extent, but I would argue it is not the primary thrust of the New Testament. Nation remains squarely at the center of God's plan. Now, hang on. But now, it's not merely a specifically located ethnicity or a particular nation state like the one we live in. Israel now has broadened her boundaries to include both Jews and Gentiles, and God has created a new nation to inherit the promises of Abraham and be, in turn, a blessing to all the nations, to all the world. In fact, it's a new nation where no one's excluded. I read it to you last week. Here's what St. Peter says. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy This is the opportunity to stir you out of slumber because of the warm temperatures in here. A holy nation. Nation. So he calls us. God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. And Isaiah corroborates Peter in verse 22 of our reading tonight. The smallest family will become 1,000 people, and the tiniest group will become a mighty nation. Powerful kings and mighty nations will meet your every need. So God's plan has always been for his people to be a nation, a community of peace. Not merely a bunch of individuals who have somehow acquired a ticket to heaven, but a nation, a body, a community. And that community is called to bring the peace of God to the world. This is the way. This is the Jesus way. There is no plan B. And we are part of that. And sometimes we slip into the mindset that this community is merely what happens within 90 minutes on a Sunday. Funny thing about Jesus, though, he never really talked about the kingdom of God in that way. Just think about the pattern of his earthly life. He had a little community of followers. They ate together, traveled together, debated politics, argued amongst each other. They went sailing occasionally. They spoke to strangers, saw miracles and tragedies, death and life, all in the span of about 3 years. His followers weren't invited into a relationship with Jesus that entailed a service at synagogue on a Saturday. They were called into an intentional, relational, life-on-life, peace-filled community with Jesus and with each other. And as it happened, with nothing in the way of credentials, God changed the world through that whole community. Isn't that remarkable? And whether we admit it or not, this kind of peaceful, authentic community is what each of one of us wants. It's what the world wants. Real community is when people are real. When masks are off. When humility is a defining trait. And confession and forgiveness are the norm, not the exception. It's where we know others and we are known by each other. And in spite of that, in spite of everything that we know about each other, we still love each other. With an honest, sacrificial, albeit sometimes tough, love. Here's the amazing part about a community like that. You would think that this kind of honesty would bring intractable conflict. But it actually opens the door to the kind of peace that changes people and nations. And that's always been God's plan, that this sort of peace and honesty would flourish within his body and then spill over into life outside of this body, so that others may come to see him. That's why God calls us into a holy nation, royal priesthood. So we have this wonderful practice that we do every Sunday. Some of you think it's wonderful. Introverts do not think it's wonderful. They dread it. It is the passing the peace. That time when we get out and start greeting one another. Have you ever wondered about the significance of that? Why we do that? There's an order to it. There's a theology to it. Think about the order of our liturgy. God calls us to worship him. That's what Matt says at the beginning of every service. Hear the call to worship. That call is coming from God himself. And then we respond. We respond to the call. And we come and we praise him. In faith, we sing about his love for us and ours for him. But we know we're sinners, right? And when we come into the presence of God, we have to be honest about it. And we need to confess that sin. And we need to rest in Christ's work to forgive and to remove all guilt. And so we do that. And that act is this community's way of saying, because of the work of Christ and our faith in Him, God, there's nothing between us. Everything's clear. And so now we can move forward in worship, God, because we've cleared the air of all of that stuff that would block or hurt or hinder our conversation, or that stuff that we try to hide and we know you see anyway. There's nothing keeping us apart. We're at peace with you, God. And then later in the service, before we hear the word and come to the sacrament, we do something similar with each other. And when we pass the peace, we're not asking God to settle tumultuous things in your life. Although that's a good thing. But that's not what we're doing. What we're saying is the peace of Christ is between us too. So there's nothing blocking us. There's nothing hindering us. There are no barriers. I have nothing against you. You have nothing against me. Now, if there was something, do you recall what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? When there's a broken relationship and someone has something against you, interestingly, we forget about that angle, right? It's not whether you have something against them, although that would apply. He says, if someone has something against you and you know about it, what does he say? Go to that person, make it right, and then do what? Bring your gift to the altar. Come worship God. And we're doing that in the middle of our service. The peace of the community precedes the sacred worship of God. That's how seriously God takes this. What we do each Sunday in passing the peace isn't a mere symbol. It is real life, on-the-job training to be God's community of peace for the world. Before it gets out there, it's got to get in here. How can we be a vehicle of peace for the world if we're not also a community of peace ourselves? And this gets real practical. Someone told me once that since he and his wife had their first child, their relationship had been strained. And they had found themselves more and more emotionally detached from each other, isolated, and just sort of cohabiting more than anything else. And this happens quite a lot for marriages. Whether it's a child or some other event, that can happen. But he said that they were determined to overcome this, so they were being honest with one another about their feelings, and they were saying them in ways where the other person could hear them and take them on board. And for the first time, they started praying together, which was strange and awkward at first, but now he said not anymore. And my suspicion is that they're not alone in their battle for peace. Their marriage. A group of men I know about decided they were tired of limping along in their Christian lives, so on their own they started meeting every Saturday morning to share what their struggles are and to pray for one another. And they're honest about every conceivable topic. And the growth in grace and peace amongst them and in their lives has been life-changing. It's impacting their families, their jobs, and others in the church. How great is that, right? The mask is off. The warts are visible. The honesty is there. And yet, there's a peace that flows in and through them that's beginning to affect the people around them. See, if we want to have a world of peace, a city of peace, we must be a community of peace ourselves. And that takes some honesty, some authenticity. Still, there's more in Isaiah 60. The eternal promises of this chapter speak not only of a new, authentic community, but also of the day when God Himself lives amongst His people and he makes them all righteous. He shines his light in and through them. Wherever they are, they will be at home, and peace is the banner that hangs on their door. That's heaven, isn't it? That's in the far beyond. We long for that day. If you've ever served on a church committee, you long for that day. But are we really just hanging on by our fingernails, waiting for the day that heaven finally arrives and we see these promises come to pass? The New Testament expresses it in every possible way that God is living with his people now. He has made all of them righteous right now. And the true light is shining in our lives. Heaven has come to earth. And it happens even now, with all our struggles, with all our mess. God is here. Not fully, true enough. We still battle against the old regime, but by the Spirit, he brings the new from that future life into the here and now because of what he has done in his Son, Jesus. And what are the terms of peace? The terms of peace with God. It begins and ends and centers upon faith in Jesus Christ. It's not based on international conferences or diplomacy. This peace is not a parenthesis between wars, nor will it win you the Nobel Prize. It's not a fickle peace that's here today and gone tomorrow. This peace is all about communities putting faith in Jesus and becoming people who lay down their sword and take up their cross. It's a peace where people are more willing to die for their enemy than to defeat them. How much must he want peace to rule us if his own Son chooses to die for us rather than to exterminate us? What an amazing God this is. Ephesians tells us that it is in the very body of Jesus Christ, in his physical body, that he made peace with God between Jews and Gentiles, bringing us all together. He put his crucified body, flesh and blood, in front of us in order to make sure that we have his eternal peace. And there's something very instructive there for us. Connect the dots with me. Christ put his flesh between God and humanity, made peace between the two, in his very flesh. And now that's what we're called to do. Physically. In real life. In 2014, there were violent, deadly protests in Ukraine. And the demonstrators and government police were in constant conflict. Many people were dying. And something incredible happened. The two warring parties could not get together to stop. But you know who intervened? Orthodox priests. They didn't sit around a table and talk about it. They went out in the middle of the conflict with guns being fired, rocks being thrown, battles being waged, and they stood there. Between the two, and they prayed. And they said, "This is not who you are. Stop, please. You're killing your own family members, your own people." And they put their lives on the line. And you can see photos on the internet now, just Google it. Ukrainian priest 2014. You'll see photos standing in the fray, kneeling, praying, asking the warring parties to be united. And that's the Christian way of peace. To stop the cycle of violence and anger theologian Miroslav Volf teaches us that it requires a community to put down arms and, rather than shooting the other in the interest of peace, embracing the other, even if it costs us our own lives. And we all long to see the world that Isaiah describes, don't we? But we need not huddle together, close our eyes, and wait for the sweet by and by. Jesus has promised his peace. He has brought it, and he calls us, the church, to live it and to take it to the world. How do we do that in Portland today?